direction. Ethan polished off the rest of his cap and walked out of the coffee shop into the street. Chimes jingled over the door as he pulled it open and stepped into the toy store. He had breathed deeply crossing Main, but still his heart was beating like crazy. Kate looked up from the book, a tattered Lee Child paperback, the last Reacher novel. It was her shock of white hair that made her look older from a distance. Close up, she was youthful. A few laugh lines, but still so goddamn pretty. Not long ago, at least from his perspective, he'd been in love with this woman. Their affair had been three of the most intense, reckless, terrifying, happy, alive months of his life. Like how he imagined being on heroin felt, if the high never ended, if every syringe didn't also contain the possibility of death. They'd been partners at the time, and there had been one week when they'd been on the road together in Northern California. Every night they rented two rooms. Every night for 5 days he stayed with her. They barely slept that week. Couldn't keep their hands off each other, couldn't stop talking when they weren't making love, and the daylight hours when they had to pretend to be professionals made it all the more beautifully excruciating. He had never felt such a complete lack of self-consciousness around anyone, even Teresa. Unconditional acceptance. Not just of his body and mind, but also of something more, of something indefinably him. Ethan had never connected with anyone on this level, but the most generous blessing and life-destroying curse all wrapped up in the same woman, and despite the pain of the guilt and the knowledge of how it would crush his wife, whom he still loved, the idea of turning away from Kate seemed like a betrayal of his soul. So she had done it for him. On a cold and rainy night in Capitol Hill, in a booth over glasses of Belgian beer in a loud, dark bar called The Stumbling Monk. He was ready to leave Teresa, to throw everything away. He had asked Kate there to tell her that, and instead she had reached across the scuffed wood of a table worn smooth by 10,000 pint glasses and broken his heart. Kate wasn't married, had no children. She wasn't ready to jump off the cliff with him when he had so much pulling him back from the ledge. 2 weeks later, she was in Boise, pursuant to her own transfer request. 1 year later, she was missing in a town in Idaho in the middle of nowhere called Wayward Pines, with Ethan off to find her. 1,800 years later, after almost everything they had known had turned to dust or eroded out of existence, here they stood, facing each other in a toy shop in the last town on Earth. For a moment, staring into her eyes at close range blanked Ethan's mind. Kate spoke first.
"I was wondering if you'd ever drop in."
"I was wondering that myself."
"Congratulations."
"For?" She reached over the counter and tapped his shiny brass star.
"Your promotion."
"Nice to see a familiar face running the show. How are you adjusting to the new job?" She was good. In this short exchange, it was obvious that Kate had mastered the superficial conversational flow that the best of Wayward Pines could achieve without straining. "It's going well," he said.
"Good to have something steady and challenging, I bet."
Kate smiled, and Ethan couldn't help hearing the subtext, wondered if everyone did, if it ever went silent. "As opposed to running half-naked through town while we all try to kill you." "The job's a good fit," he said.
"That's great. Really happy for you."
"So, to what do I owe the pleasure?" "I just wanted to pop in and say hi."
"Well, that was nice of you. How's your son?"
"Ben's great," Ethan said.
"He's sure growing up fast."
"That's the truth."
God, it felt so stilted talking to her, like bad dialogue in a novel or actors reading lines.
Hammering started up next door, Harold building something. "How's your husband?" Ethan asked. He didn't like the word, not when it applied to the man who'd been fucking Kate for the last 7 years. Or was it possible their marriage was a sham? That she secretly hated him, but kept up appearances? Had never let him touch her.
"He's wonderful," she said. and the authenticity of her smile contradicted everything that had come before, called it all out for the lie it was. She loved Harold. She'd lit up saying his name. In this moment, and only for a flicker of time, Ethan had glimpsed the real Kate.
"He's next door?" Ethan asked.
"Yes, that's him hammering away at something. We like to say he's the brawn and I'm the brains of this operation." Ethan forced a laugh, said,
"I've never met him. Well, not really met him."
He thought she might read his intent, offer to make an introduction, but she only said, "You will. He's a little under the gun this afternoon, filling an order for the school. Why don't you pick out something for Ben? Anything in the store? On the house?"
"I couldn't."
"I insist."
"You're too kind."
Ethan moved away from the cash register. It wasn't a large store, but shelves brimmed, floor to ceiling, with handmade toys. He lifted a wooden car. It had wheels that spun, doors, hood, and a trunk that opened and closed.
"This is really good," he said.
"Harold's work is amazing." Ethan put the car back on the shelf. Kate moved out from behind the counter. She wore a yellow dress, the color of turning aspen leaves. Her figure almost unchanged. "How old is Ben now?" she asked.
"He's 12.
Tough age when traditional toys begin to lose their appeal. She walked to the back of the store. Bare feet on hard wood that almost glowed under the late afternoon light slanting through the storefront windows. "But I might just have the right thing." She stood on the balls of her feet and reached up to a slingshot on the highest shelf. The craftsmanship was simple but exact. Carved raw wood, sanded smooth. A thick rubber band attached to the forks of the Y and a brown leather pocket.
"This is perfect," Ethan said.
"It's my pleasure." As he grasped the slingshot, his other hand reached down and touched Kate's hand. The hammering had stopped next door, but the commotion of Ethan's heart sounded deafening in the quiet of the store. He stared down into her eyes, which seemed somehow bluer than he remembered, and unfurled the fingers of her left hand, fighting to ignore the electricity as their skin touched. She didn't pull away. Her eyes flicked down at their hands. She took the scrap of paper from him, clutched it in her fist. Ethan said, "It's really good to see you again," and walked out of the store. The bells jingled on the inner doorknob of Wayward Pines Realty Associates. Teresa looked up from her desk as a man she'd never laid eyes on before walked into her office. She could tell immediately that he was new in town, whatever that meant. He looked sheet pale and bewildered. Stopping at the edge of her desk, he asked,
"Are you Teresa Burke?"
"I am."
"They said I should talk to you about a house, but I don't really know what..."
"Yes, of course. I can help you with that. What's your name?"
Wayne? Wayne Johnson."
She reached over and shook his hand. "Pleasure to meet you, Wayne. Please have a seat." She pulled out her binder of available listings and slid it across the desk to him. He hesitated. For a moment she wondered if he was on the verge of storming out. But he flipped it open, started turning through the pages. She hated this. It was one thing to help someone who'd been in Wayward Pines for several years upgrade to a new house. They knew the deal, knew how to bullshit. But this poor man had just arrived. He had no idea what was happening to him, why he was here, why he couldn't leave. She wondered if they'd threatened him yet. After a minute, he leaned forward. "See something you like?" Teresa asked. He whispered under his breath.
"What's going on here?"
Teresa said. "What do you mean?" "We're just looking at real estate." "Look, I know buying a new house can be overwhelming, but I'm here to help." And she said it like she almost believed it. Through the storefront window, something caught her eye, across the street. Ethan was emerging from Wooden Treasures with a slingshot in his hand. Through the window behind the kitchen sink, Ethan watched the sky fading toward dusk. Houses began to glow. The valley filled with piano, courtesy of Hector Gaither. A winter's coming chill sharpened the breeze pushing through the screen.
Ethan had been noticing it more and more when the sun went behind the mountains. The cold sank almost instantly into town, an aggressiveness to the onset which he found disturbing. He'd heard talk that the winters here were long and legendary. Ethan let his hands linger in the warm dishwater. Suddenly, Teresa was beside him. She set a plate down hard on the butcher block. "Everything okay?" Ethan asked. She'd been weird during dinner, weird even for Wayward Pines. Hadn't spoken a word, hadn't taken her eyes off her plate. She looked up at him. "Aren't you forgetting something?" she asked.
"No."
She was angry, her green eyes smoldering. "Didn't you have something for Ben?" Shit. She'd seen him. Somehow she'd seen him in the toy shop. But he hadn't brought the slingshot home. He'd gone to his office instead, checked in with Belinda, stashed Kate's gift in the bottom drawer of his desk, hoping to avoid this exact conversation. "What'd you do with it?" she asked. "I think your son would love to own a slingshot." "Teresa, oh my God, are you actually going to try and deny it?" He pulled his hands out of the water, dried them on the towel hanging from the stove door handle. Felt an awful metal burn in the back of his throat that reminded him of the night he'd told Teresa about Kate. His ex-partner was already in Boise when he'd sat Teresa down and spilled everything. He couldn't live with the lie between them. Respected her too much. Loved her too much. It had never been about him not loving his wife. Teresa didn't understand. That hadn't been a surprise, but she didn't throw him out either, and that had been. She had cried and been devastated, but in the end, loved him all the same. Still. Despite. And the strangest thing happened. Her response made him love her more. Showed him his wife in a light he'd never seen, or rather had missed. Teresa took a step toward him. "I saw you there," she said. "In her shop. I saw you." "I was there," Ethan said. "She gave me the slingshot for Ben, and I didn't bring it home because you wanted to hide it from me." "Why would she give me something clearly from her if we were doing something behind your back?" "But you did hide it from me." "Yes." Teresa shut her eyes, and for a moment, Ethan thought she might be on the brink of going to pieces. She opened them again, said, "Then why did you go to see her?" Ethan put his hands on the stovetop and leaned back. "It's work, Teresa, and that's all I can say." "Work. I would never have gone to her otherwise. And I'm just supposed to take your word for that. I love you, and I wish I'd never met her. You have no idea." "What am I supposed to do with that?" Teresa ran the tap and filled a glass, drank it down, set it down. Staring through the window screen, she said, "Look, you got something from her that you couldn't get from me. Some kind of experience beyond ours. I don't hate you for it. I never did." She turned from the sink and faced him, steam rising off the surface of the soapy water. Gaither was playing one of Mozart's piano concertos. "But that doesn't mean you didn't hurt me," she said. "I know that." "I wonder if she makes you feel the way you make me feel. You don't have to try and answer that." "So it's for work, huh?"
"Yeah."
"So I guess that means..."
"I can't talk about it."
She nodded. "I'm gonna draw a bath. I'm over here, Teresa. Completely." He watched his wife walk out of the kitchen, listened to the hardwood floor creaking under her footfalls as she moved down the hall toward the bathroom. A door closed. After a minute, he heard the muffled sound of water splashing into the clawfoot tub. Ethan crawled into bed under the covers. He lay on his side with his head propped up with one arm, watching his wife sleep. The warmth of her body heated the space between the sheet and the comforter. She'd left the window cracked open an inch off the sill, and the air creeping in was cold enough to make him wish he'd pulled another blanket out of the oak chest at the foot of their bed. He thought he might drift off for a half hour or so, and he tried to shut his eyes, but it just wasn't happening. So rarely did his mind ever stop. Kate had undoubtedly read his note. But what had she made of it? Sitting in the coffee shop 7 hours ago, he'd finally decided on a course of action. Ripped a strip of blank newsprint off the latest edition of The Wayward Light and written, "They know about you. They're watching you. They sent me to investigate you. Mausoleum, 2 a.m. tonight." Chapter 12. 1:55 a.m. No moon and a billion stars in a black, black sky. Frigid. The small duckless pond in the city park beginning to rim with ice. In the afternoon, one of Pilcher's men had delivered a new Bronco to the curb in front of Ethan's house, the SUV identical to its predecessor, if not a trace shinier. But Ethan had chosen to walk. He thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his parka, fingertips tingling in the cold. Soon he was moving alongside the river, the ruckus of water passing over rocks and the clean, sweet smell of it in the night air. Had it only been 2 weeks since he'd crossed this river in the dead of night, the entire town in pursuit and fled up canyon? He didn't feel anything like that man anymore. Ethan climbed over a disintegrating stone wall that looked straight out of a Frost poem, the rocks cold as blocks of ice to the touch. The gravestones glowed like ancient faces under the starlight, and the sound of the river fell away. Ethan passed through waist-high weeds, through groves of scrub oak. Here among the dead at the south end of town, the lights of wayward pines were all but invisible. The mausoleum appeared in the distance. Had she come? The old Kate would have, no question. But what about the new one? The Kate who'd lived in Wayward Pines for 9 years, the Kate he no longer knew. Something loitered in the back of his mind, something ugly and off balance. Fear. What if Kate and her group had tortured and murdered Alyssa Pilcher? You have no idea what she's capable of. He couldn't rid himself of what Pilcher had said yesterday morning, and as he approached the crypt, it occurred to him, "I should have brought my gun." The mausoleum stood in a stand of mature aspen trees that had already dropped their leaves, gold coins scattered in the dying weeds. The stone planters that framed the iron door had long since crumbled, but the columns retained their form. There was no wind. The river nothing more than a whisper. He said, "Kate." No answer. Dug a flashlight out of his pocket, swept the beam through the aspen, called her name again. Ethan forced the heavy door open, its bottom dragging across the stone with a teeth-aching groan. He put his light inside. It fired the stone walls. The stained-glassed window in the back. She wasn't there. He walked slowly around the perimeter of the crypt, shining his light into the surrounding weeds, which were already bending under the weight of a fragile glaze of frost. Ice crystals glittering in the beam. He arrived back at the entrance and sat down on the steps between the columns as the realization slowly dawned that she hadn't come. He'd made a risky play, tipped his hand, and scared her off. What would she do now? Run? He killed the light. The walk over from his house and the anticipation of seeing her had bolstered him against the cold, but now it came streaming in. He struggled onto his feet, drew in a sudden breath. Kate stood 5 feet away, a ghost in the dark, dressed completely in black with a hoodie pulled over her head. As she moved forward, the blade of the butcher knife in her hand threw a glint of starlight. Ethan said, "A knife, really?" "Thought I might be coming to a fight." "Did you now?" "Never know these days." "Will you put it the fuck down? I didn't even bring a gun." She just stared at him. He couldn't read her eyes in the low light, but her mouth was a thin, tight line. "What, you don't believe me? Want to pat me down, Agent Hewson?" "Open your jacket." Kate slipped her knife into a makeshift sheath that had been constructed out of duct tape. Her hands slid around his waist, then up and down his thighs. Fast, thorough. "You still got it," Ethan said.
"Got what?"
"Still frisk like a pro." Kate stepped back, She looked at him with a hardness he'd not seen in her eyes before, at least not aimed at him.
"Are you fucking with me?" she said.
"No. Are you here alone?"
"Yes."
"Where's Harold?"
"You think we're dumb enough to let you take both of us?"
"No one's trying to take you, Kate. At least not tonight."
"I don't even know if I believe you."
"But you came."
"I had a choice?"
"How about we talk inside?"
"Fine."
Ethan followed her up the stone steps into the crypt. When they were both inside, she put her shoulder into the door and forced it shut. Turned around, faced Ethan in the dark.
"Are you chipped?" she asked.
"Yeah."
"So they know you're here?"
"Probably." Kate spun and grabbed for the door handle, but Ethan dragged her back.
"Let go!"
"Relax, Kate. It doesn't matter."
"The hell it doesn't. They know you're here."
"Only my location. The mausoleum isn't mic'd. I'm not mic'd."
"But they know you're talking to me tonight?"
"They sent me." She shoved him back toward the stained glass window with a surprising burst of force and smoothed her clothes. Ethan fished his flashlight out of his pocket, turned it on, set it on the floor between them. The light streaming up lit their faces grotesquely, their breath steaming in the cold.
"I need you to trust me, Kate."
She leaned back against the wall, said,
"I need you to prove that I can."
"How do I do that?"
"What do you know about me?"
"They know that you and others remove your chips, that sometimes you go out at night."
"And they sent you to investigate me?" she asked.
"That's right."
"For what?"
"You really want to play it that way?"
"I don't know what you're talking about. 2 weeks ago, you're turning this town upside down, desperate to leave. Now you're sheriff? Clearly working for them?"
"So you know there's a them."
"What idiot doesn't?"
"What else do you know, Kate?" She eased down onto the floor. Ethan sat too.
"I know there's a fence around the outskirts of town. I know we're all under surveillance, all the time. I know that 2 weeks ago you wanted the truth."
"Have you gone beyond the fence?"
Kate hesitated, then shook her head. "Have you?"
She must have read it in his face, said before he even had a chance to lie,
"Oh my God, you have."
"Tell me about Alyssa." Kate didn't flinch exactly, but he read the surprise in her eyes.
"What about her?"
"You know she was killed 2 nights ago?"
"Are you serious?"
"She was found naked in the middle of the road, stabbed to death, tortured."
"Oh, Jesus."
She let out a long, trembling breath.
"Who found her?"
"I did."
"Why are you asking me about this?"
"Kate."
"What?"
"You think they didn't know you were talking to Alyssa?" Her eyes darted, a flicker of panic setting in.
"She came to me," Kate whispered.
"I know. I saw the footage. You were supposed to meet with her the night she died."
"How do you know that?"
He didn't answer, just let the realization come. Kate's face fell.
"Oh. I see. She was with them."
"Yeah."
"A spy."
"What happened that night, Kate?" "You were supposed to meet her here at 1 in the morning. She documented everything. What happened?" Kate stared at the floor. He said, "Maybe you'll believe this, maybe you won't. But I am here as your friend."
"I don't believe it."
"Why?"
"Because I can't take the risk of being wrong."
"Tell me what happened. I can help you."
"Do I need your help?"
"In the worst way."
"What's on the other side of the fence?"
"Don't ask me that."
"I need to know.
What happened to Alyssa?"
"I don't know."
"Did you kill her?"
"You tell me. Am I a murderer?"
"I don't know you anymore." Kate stood.
"That hurts more than you know."
"Did you kill her?"
"No."
Ethan grabbed his flashlight, struggled up onto his feet.
"Tell me what you're into." "Goodbye, Ethan. I need to know. For you, or for the people who hold your leash?"
"They will kill you, Kate. You and Harold. They will disappear you."
I know the risk.
And
I live my life on my terms. If my terms lead me down that road, so be it. I just want to help you. Whose side are you on, Ethan? Really?
I don't know yet. She smiled.
First honest thing you've said to me. Thank you for that.
She reached out and took hold of his hand. Her fingers were ice, but the shape of the hand was familiar. The last time he'd held it was 2,000 years ago, on a beach in Northern California. Kate said,
"You're scared."
Her face was inches from his, her attention like a heat lamp. "Aren't we all?"
"I've been here 9 years. I don't know where I am, or why. Sometimes I think we're all dead, but in the quiet, dark hours of the night, I know that isn't true."
"What are you doing when you leave your house at night?"
"What's beyond the fence?"
"I can protect you, Kate. But you have to—"
"I don't want your protection."
She tugged the door open, stepped back out into the night. 5 steps from the crypt, she stopped, turned, stared back at Ethan.
"The last time I saw Alyssa alive was 2 nights ago.
"Where did you see her last?"
"We parted ways on Main Street. We didn't kill her, Ethan."
"But she was with you the night she died."
"Yes."
"Where?" Kate shook her head. "Where do you go at night, Kate? And why?"
"What's beyond the fence?"
When he didn't answer, she smiled.
"Thought so."
"Do you love him?"
"Excuse me?"
"Your husband? Do you love him? Is it real?" The smile vanished.
"See you later, Sheriff."
He walked home, not knowing. Not knowing if Kate had lied to him. Not knowing if she had been on the other side of the fence. Not knowing if she had killed Alyssa. Not knowing a goddamn thing. She'd had that effect in their relationship, too. He'd spend a day with her that felt like bliss in the moment, then come out on the other side unsure of where he stood. Second-guessing everything. He'd never understood if it was a conscious play on her part or his own failing in letting this woman get so deep and tangled in his head. He pulled off his boots just inside the front door and crept across the hardwood to the staircase. It was cold in the house, the floor cracking and popping under the weight of his footsteps. Down the upstairs hallway to his son's bedroom, the door was open. He moved to the bed. Couldn't have been warmer than 45 degrees in the room. Ben slept buried under 5 blankets, but Ethan pulled them up a little closer around his neck, touched the back of his hand to the boy's cheek. Soft and warm. Truckloads of firewood were due to arrive any day now. Word was, town burned copious amounts of pine for heat through the winter, with each household receiving 6 cords. Pilcher had a small army of men making daily trips beyond the fence under heavily armed protection, cutting trees and splitting wood for the entire town. Ethan headed for his bedroom. Stripped off his pants and shirt, left them in a pile in the doorway. The floor was freezing. He hustled to the bed. Crawling under the covers, he turned over onto his side and pulled Teresa in close. She radiated heat. He kissed the back of her neck. Sleep seemed like a long shot. Almost impossible lately to turn down the noise in the back of his mind. He shut his eyes. Maybe it would come anyway.
"Ethan?"
"Hey, baby," he whispered. She rolled over, faced him, her breath in his face a familiar, gentle heat.
"Get your feet off of mine. They're ice."
"Sorry, I wake you?" he asked.
"When you left?" "Where'd you go?"
"Work."
"To see her?"
"I can't."
"Ethan?"
"What?"
"Where?"
"It doesn't matter, Teresa." "It really doesn't.
I can't keep doing this."
"Doing what? Us?"
"This town, and us in it. You, her, your job."
She leaned in close, pressed her lips against his ear, whispered,
"Can I keep talking like this, or will they hear us?"
He hesitated.
"I'm going to anyway, Ethan.
then just be still.
What?
Be completely still.
Why?
Will you just do it? In particular, don't move your left leg. They lay still. He could feel his wife's heart beating against his chest. Ethan counted to 15 in his head, then whispered, "Speak no louder than this."
"I used to think that if I could only be with you again, have you here with us, that I could do this, buy into the lie.
And?
I can't."
"You don't have a choice, Teresa. Do you know the danger you're putting our family in just having this conversation?"
Her mouth pushed harder into his ear. A chill shot down his spine. "I want to leave this place. I'm done, Ethan. I don't care what could happen to us. I just want out."
"Do you care what happens to our son?" Ethan whispered.
"This isn't a life. I don't care if we all die."
"Good. Because we will."
"You know that for sure?"
100%.
"Because you know?"
"Yes."
"What's out there, Ethan?"
"We can't have this conversation."
"I am your wife."
Their bodies were pushed against each other. Her legs were cool and smooth against his skin, and the heat coming off her was driving him mad. He wanted to shake her, wanted to fuck her.
"Why the hell are you getting hard?"
"I don't know."
"What's out there, Ethan?"
"You really want to know?" And then her hand was on his cock.
"Are you thinking about her?"
"No."
"Swear to me."
"I swear." She slid away, down under the covers, and took him in her mouth. Brought him right to the edge. Then she came up and pulled off her nightie. She was sitting on top of him and her breath clouding. She leaned over and kissed him, her nipples hard against his chest in the cold. Teresa rolled over onto her back and pulled Ethan with her, pulling him inside. She was loud and she sounded so beautiful. As she started to come, she brought Ethan's head down, her lips to his ear, his lips to hers. She moaned and said,
"Tell me."
"What?" He was breathless.
"Tell me, oh God, Ethan, where we really are."
Ethan buried his face into her ear.
"We're all that's left, baby."
They were coming together, loud and hard, as in sync as they'd ever been.
"This is the last town on earth."
Teresa shouting, "Yes, yes, oh God, don't stop," loud enough to cover his words.
"And we're surrounded by monsters."
They lay entwined and sweaty and perfectly still. Ethan whispering into her ear. He told her everything. When they were. Where they were. About Pilcher. About the Abbeys. Then he lay with his head propped up on one elbow, stroking her face. Teresa stared at the ceiling. She'd been here 5 years, a hell of a lot longer than he had, but it had been a state of limbo, of not really knowing. Now she did. Perhaps she had suspected before, but all uncertainty had just been burned away. Aside from Ethan and Ben, she would never again see all of the people she had loved in her life before. They had been dead 2 millennia. And if she'd ever held out hope for leaving Wayward Pines, Ethan had just destroyed it. There was no end date for her sentence in this place. She was a lifer. Ethan wondered which emotion was dominant, figured a full cocktail was flailing away inside her head, anger, despair, heartbreak, fear. By the light of a distant street lamp coming through the window, he watched tears form in her eyes, felt her hand begin to tremble in his. Chapter 13. Water Tower Volunteer Park, Seattle, 2013. As Hassler approached the entrance to the water tower, a woman stepped out of the shadows beside the door. She said, "You're late."
"By 5 minutes. Relax. He up there?"
"Yeah." She couldn't have been much older than 20. A thin, muscular build, crazy gorgeous, but with dead eyes. An interesting choice for Pilcher's muscle. She certainly put out the confidence of someone who could handle herself. She stood between Hassler and the door, blocking his way. He said, "Do you mind?" For a beat, it seemed like she might, but she finally stepped aside. As Hassler moved past, he said, "Don't let anyone come up. Thanks for telling me how to do my job, G-Man." The metal clanged under Hassler's wingtips. He trudged up the stairs. The observation level was low-lit, a circular brick wall punctuated with arched windows that had been covered in heavy-gauge screens to stop anyone from going through. More floor-to-ceiling fencing guarded the 75-foot drop into the open spiral staircase. Wearing a long black coat and a bowler hat, David Pilcher sat on a bench on the other side of the observation deck. Hassler circled around and took a seat beside him. For a moment, nothing but the sound of rain hammering on the roof above them. Pilcher looked over with the faintest smile.
"Agent Hassler."
"David?" Out the window, the skyline of Seattle looked like a neon blur through the low cloud deck. Pilcher reached into his coat and took out a fat envelope, set it in Hassler's lap. Hassler carefully opened it, peeked inside, thumbed through the $100 bills.
"Looks like $30,000 to me," he said, resealing the envelope.
"You have news?" Pilcher asked. "It's been 15 months since Agent Burke's disappearance and Agent Stalling's death. There have been no leads, no new evidence. Now don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying anyone at the Treasury Department is ever going to forget that we had one agent killed and 3 go MIA in Wayward Pines, Idaho. But with no new information, they're just spinning in their tracks, and they know it. 2 days ago, the internal investigation into my missing agents was officially deprioritized."
"What do your people think happened?"
"The theories?"
"Yeah."
"It's all over the map, but nothing remotely close to the bullseye. They had Ethan Burke's hope service today."
"What's a hope service?"
"Fuck if I know."
"You went?"
"I went to the after-party at Teresa's house. I'm going to pay her a visit after you and I are finished."
"Really?"
"It's time."
"Teresa and Ben?"
"I have a theory that if I can keep families together when possible, the transition will be smoother on the other side."
Hassler stood, walked over to the window, stared out past the glass conservatory, which was illuminated with holiday lights. He could hear traffic and live music down in Capitol Hill, but up here at the top of the water tower, he felt removed from everything.
Hassler said, "Have you given any thought to what we talked about last time?"
"I have."
"And you?"
"It's all I think about."
Hassler turned, stared at Pilcher.
"What will it be like?"
"What will what be like?"
"Wayward Pines. When you come out of whatever it is you call suspended animation?"
Pilcher's face grew dark. He said, "You already know far more about my project than I'm comfortable with."
"If I wanted to bring you down, David, I could have done that months ago."
"If I wanted you dead, Agent Hassler, you and everyone you love, there is nothing in the world stopping me from making that happen. Not from prison, not from the grave."
"So we've established trust," Hassler said.
"Perhaps, or at the very least, assured mutual destruction. No difference in my book."
Freezing spits of rain blew in the window. Hassler felt them, misting the back of his neck with an unpleasant chill.
"So back to my question, David. What will it be like when you all wake up?"
"At first, work. Lots and lots of work. The town will have to be rebuilt. That'll take some time. But then, I don't know. We're talking 2,000 years from now. This tower we're standing in will be in ruin. That skyline? gone. All the people in this city, and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, disintegrated into nothing. Even their bones.
Hassler clutched the fencing over the window.
I want to be a part of it.
It's no guarantee, Adam.
I understand that.
This is Columbus in search of the East Indies. Man flying to the moon. A million things could go wrong and we never wake up. An asteroid could hit. An earthquake. We could wake to a toxic atmosphere or a hostile world we never imagined.
Do you really think that'll happen?
I have no idea what we'll be waking up to. Only an image in my head of this perfect little town where humanity gets a chance to start over. That's all that's ever driven me.
So you'd let me come along?
I'm already fully staffed. What skill set would you bring?
Intelligence, ability to lead, several skills. I was a Delta Force operator before I joined the Secret Service. But I'm sure you already know that.
Pilcher just smiled, said,
Well, I guess you're in.
I have one favor to ask, and if you agree to it, you can have this envelope back.
What?
Ethan Burke never wakes up.
Why?
I want to be there with Teresa.
Teresa Burke?
That's right. Ethan's wife.
Yes,
Pilcher said.
Are you in love with her?
I am, actually.
And is she in love with you?
Not yet. She's never stopped loving him.
Hassler felt the ulcer flaring in his stomach, that green flame of envy.
He cheats on her with his ex-partner, Kate Hewson, and still she takes him back.
Still she loves him.
Have you ever met Teresa Burke?
No, but I will shortly.
He doesn't deserve her.
And you do.
I would love that woman like she was meant to be loved. She'll be happier with me in Wayward Pines than she's ever been in her life.
It took his breath away to say the words, to give them voice. He'd never shared this with anyone. Pilcher laughed as he rose to his feet.
So at the end of the day, this is all just about you getting a girl?
No, it's...
I'm kidding. I'll make it happen.
The men shook hands.
When do we go under? Hassler asked.
It's called de-animation. My superstructure is finished. All that's left is to stock the warehouse and collect the last few recruits. I'm 64 years old, not getting any younger. And there's going to be loads to do on the other side.
So?
We're having a party on New Year's Eve in Wayward Pines. Me, my family, and 120 members of my crew are going to drink the best champagne money can buy and go to sleep for a couple thousand years. You're welcome to join.
2 weeks?
2 weeks.
Where will people think you've gone?
I've made arrangements. It's been 7 years since my last public lecture. I've become a recluse. I'm guessing it's 50-50 whether the AP even carries my obit.
What about you?
Considered how you'll make your exit?
I'll cash out my 401k, empty my bank accounts, leave a messy trail to some shady purveyor of fake passports.
That isn't the hard part.
What is?
Hassler glanced back out the window toward the mist-enshrouded hills of Queen Anne. Teresa Burke's neighborhood.
Knowing I have to wait 2,000 years to be with the woman of my dreams.
Part 3. Chapter 14. Tobias lay flat on his stomach in the swaying grasses. He barely breathed. 500 yards away, the abbey emerged out of the forest of lodgepole pines. It entered the field, moving at a comfortable lope in Tobias's general direction.
Fuck.
Tobias had just come out of a forest on the opposite side of the field not 5 minutes prior. 30 minutes before that,
He'd crossed a stream and lingered half a second on the bank, debating whether or not to stop for a drink. He'd decided to push on. If he hadn't, he'd have spent 5 or 10 minutes drinking his fill and replenishing his 1-liter bottles. Upshot being, he would have arrived at the edge of this field with the Abbey already out in the open, could have tracked its trajectory from the cover and safety of the woods, made certain to avoid the precise situation of fuckness he now found himself in. He was going to have to shoot it. A run-in was inevitable. It was midday. The Abbey was downwind. No other option with him stuck out here and the nearest patch of trees several football fields away. The creature's sense of smell, sight, and hearing was so finely tuned, the moment he stood, it would spot him. Considering the wind direction, it was going to smell him any second now. Tobias had dropped his pack and rifle in the grass at his first glimpse of movement in the distance. Now he reached out, grabbed his Winchester Model 70. He gripped the fore-end stock and came up on his right elbow, settled in behind the scope. It hadn't been zeroed out in ages, and as the Abbey came into focus in the reticle, Tobias thought of all the times the scope had been jostled when he'd leaned the gun against a tree or thrown it down. All the rain and the snow that had beaten the shit out of his weapon in his 1,000-plus days in the wild. He gauged its distance at 200 yards now. Still a long shot, but its center mass loomed large in the crosshairs. He made a slight adjustment for the wind. His heart beat against the ground that was still cold from last night's freeze. It had been weeks, months maybe, since his last encounter. He'd had ammo for his .357 then. God, he missed that gun. If he'd still had his revolver, he'd have stood up, shouted, let that beast come running at him, blown its brains out from close range. He could see its heart pulsing in the crosshairs, pushed off the safety, touched his finger to the trigger. He didn't want to pull. A gunshot out here would announce his presence to everything in a 3-mile radius. Thinking, just let it pass, maybe it won't see you. And then, no, you have to put it down. The report echoed across the field, deflected off the distant wall of trees, and began to slowly fade away. Miss. The Abbey stood motionless, frozen mid-stride on 2 legs that looked as sturdy as oak, its nose tipped up to the wind. There was a beard of dried blood down its face and neck from a recent kill. Tough to judge size through a scope, and truthfully, it didn't matter. Even the smaller ones that clocked in around 120 pounds were absolutely lethal. Tobias turned the bolt handle up, jerked it back. The spent cartridge spit out with a puff of smoke. He shoved the bolt forward, locked it down, looked back through the scope. Damn, it had covered some ground, the Abbey hauling ass now across the meadow at a full sprint in that low, scuttling gait reminiscent of a pit bull. In his life before, Tobias had seen combat all over the world. Mogadishu, Baghdad, Kandahar, the coca fields of Colombia. Hostage rescue, high-value target acquisitions, off-grid assassinations. None of it could hold a candle to the shit-yourself fear evoked by a charging Abbey. 150 yards and closing, no idea how off his scope was, he put the crosshair's center mass. The rifle bucked hard against his shoulder, and a streak of blood appeared across the Abbey's left side. He'd barely grazed its ribs, the creature still coming, undaunted. But now he knew the scope's deviation, off a few degrees right and down. Tobias ejected the spent shell, jacked a new cartridge into the chamber, locked down the bolt, made the adjustment to the scope. He could hear it now, rapid breathing and the sound of talons ripping through grass, noted a strange swell of confidence. He put the crosshairs on its head and fired. When the wind pushed the gun smoke out of the way, Tobias saw the Abbey face down and motionless in the grass, the back of its head blown out. Kill number 45. He sat up, hands sweating through his fingerless gloves. A scream erupted from the woods. He raised the rifle, scoped the line of trees 1/3 of a mile away,
A second scream followed. A third. He couldn't see anything distinctly in the trees, just movement in the shadows. The realization hit with a sickening burst of fear. There were more of them. He'd only killed a scout for a larger swarm. Shouldering his pack, he grabbed the Winchester and took off across the field. The forest he moved toward stood a quarter mile away. He slid the rifle strap over his shoulder and accelerated to a dead run, arms pumping, glancing left every few strides in the direction of the screams, which were growing louder and more frequent over his own breathless gasps.
"Hit the trees before they see you. For God's sake, if you reach the woods, you might live. If the swarm spots you, you die in the next 10 minutes."
He looked back, saw the dead Abby in the grass, the line of woods beyond, but no other movement in the field. Straight on, the trees that would have saved him stood 50 yards away. He hadn't run for his life in more than a year. Staying alive beyond the fence was an art based upon the principle of avoidance. You never charged ahead into unknown territory. You always took your time, walked softly, stayed in the trees whenever possible, ventured out into the open only when necessary. You didn't rush, left nothing to track. And if you stayed alert every second of every day, you had a chance at staying alive. He finally reached the trees just as the first of the Abbeys broke out into the clearing. He didn't know if he'd been seen, and he couldn't see them now, couldn't hear them. There was nothing now but the riot inside his own chest, his own gasping. He plowed between trees, branches grabbing at his arms. A limb sliced open the right side of his face. Blood ran over his lip. He leaped over a downed log and glanced back when he hit the ground on the other side, nothing to see but a blur of juggling green. His legs burned, lungs burned. He couldn't keep this up much longer. Out into a clearing studded with boulders and backed by a 70-foot cliff. The temptation to climb to safety was primal but misguided. Abbeys could climb almost as fast as they could run. A stream meandered through the clearing. His boots pounded in the water. Screams tore through the woods behind him. He was coming to his end. Simply couldn't keep going like this. He shot into a grove of scrub oak, the leaves crimson. Done. He hit the wall within range of a thicket, fell to his knees, dragged himself into the bushes. Dizzy with exhaustion, Tobias set the gun down and ripped his pack open. "Is this, after everything, the place where I die?" The box of 30-30 cartridges was on top. Always. Tore it open, started feeding rounds into the receiver just forward of the bolt. He loaded 2 in the magazine, the last into the chamber, and shoved the bolt home. Rolled over onto his stomach. The foliage surrounding him was orange. The air carried the scent of dying leaves, his heart still slamming like it was trying to burst out of his chest. He stared back through the woods into the clearing. They were coming. No telling how large of a swarm he was dealing with. If he was spotted and their number was more than 5, buenas fucking noches. If he was spotted, their number was 5 or under, and he made every shot count, he had a slim chance. But if he missed or didn't make kill shots every time, if he was forced to reload, he would die. No pressure. He glanced the boulder-strewn clearing through the scope. It wasn't the first time he was faced with the prospect of not making it back to Wayward Pines. He was already overdue by 4 months. It was possible they had declared him KIA. Pilcher would wait a little longer. Give him a good 6-month past due window to return before sending someone else beyond the fence, deep into hostile country. But what were the chances another nomad would find what he had found? What were the chances they would survive as long as he had? An Abbey streaked into the clearing. Then another. And another. A 4th. 5th. No more. Please, no. A group of 5 joined the others. Then 10 more. Soon there were 25 of them milling around the boulders in the shadow of that cliff. His heart fell. He crawled back, deep into the thicket, dragging his pack and his rifle with him out of sight. No chance now. The light began to fail. He kept replaying what had happened, trying to pinpoint the lapse in judgment, the misstep, but there wasn't one.
He had waited at the edge of that field 5 minutes before walking out into it. Glassed the surrounding terrain, listened. He hadn't rushed out into anything. Sure, he could have circumnavigated that piece of open country, kept to the perimeter of the woods. That would have taken him the entire day. No, you couldn't second-guess a choice like that. There'd been nothing reckless in it. By his reckoning, Wayward Pines lay nestled 30 or 40 miles east of his position. 4 days of smooth-sailing travel. 10 in bad weather or with minor injuries. He was almost there, for Christ's sake. For the last 3 days he'd been climbing into high country, fir and aspen starting to mix in with the pines. Colder mornings. He could even feel the air thinning out in those deep breaths that never quite filled his lungs. For fuck's sake! Now this? Calm down, soldier. Secure that shit. He shut his eyes, willed the panic to subside. A small rock lay in the leaves beside his right hand. He picked it up and began to quietly carve the 45th notch into the stock of his Winchester. Evening fell. They hadn't detected him, but they hadn't left either. It was strange. He'd witnessed Abby's following scent trails before, recalled a night he'd spent 40 feet up in a pine tree. In the morning, he'd watched an Abby pass 50 yards away, its nose to the ground, clearly on the trail of something. Maybe it was a brook. He'd crossed in a frenzy, but the water had come to his knees. Perhaps he'd shed his scent trail, or at least enough for it to throw them off. Truth was, he didn't know exactly how keen the Abbey's olfactory abilities were, or what exactly they tracked. Dead skin cells? The odor of freshly trampled grass? God forbid they were as gifted as bloodhounds. The sun dropped. The Abbeys settled into the clearing. Some of them curled into small, fetal balls against the boulders and slept. Others lounged by the stream and dipped their claws into the current. After a while, a band of 4 disappeared into the woods. He'd never been so close to a swarm. Hidden in the thicket, he glimpsed Abbeys no taller than 4 feet. 40 yards from where he lay, a trio of them splashed in the stream where it hooked back into the forest, their interaction an unsettling amalgamation of wrestling lion cubs and human children playing a game of tag. He grew cold, and his thirst was maddening. He had a half-filled bottle in his pack, and he could see his thirst driving him to risk discovery and reach for it, but he wasn't that desperate. Yet. At dusk, the 4 Abbeys returned from the woods. They had brought something back, which 2 of their number carried between them, the creature thrashing and bleating as they emerged into the clearing. The swarm surrounded them, the clearing filled with clicks and screeches. He'd heard this many times, some kind of communication. As the Abbeys formed a circle, there was enough noise for Tobias to risk lifting his rifle to watch through the scope. The hunters had caught an elk, a gangly teenage buck with the start of a rack of antlers just beginning to rise between its ears. It stood tottering in the circle, its right hind leg badly broken, hoof raised off the ground, a white streak of bone showing through its hock. One of the large males shoved a young Abbey out into the circle. The swarm screeched in unison, talons lifting to the sky. The young Abbey stood frozen. It received another hard shove. After a moment it began to stalk its prey, the elk retreating awkwardly on 3 legs. This went on for a while like some horrifying ballet. Suddenly the young Abbey charged and flung itself at the wounded animal, talons out. The elk swung its head, connected, sent the Abbey sprawling back across the ground. The swarm descended into mayhem that sounded disturbingly like laughter. Another youngster was pushed out into the circle. 4.5 feet tall, 80 pounds if Tobias had to guess. It charged the elk and leapt onto its back, talons digging in, its weight bringing the wounded buck to its knees. The elk raised its head and made a helpless bugle as the young Abbey buried its face into the hide and slashed wildly. The game went on, the young ones taking turns chasing the elk around the circle, biting, scratching, drawing blood here and there, but none of them coming close to inflicting serious damage. Finally, a 6-foot bull jumped out into the circle, grabbed the young Abby by its neck, and pried it off the elk's back. Holding the youngster up inches away from its own face, it screeched something that sounded like annoyance. It dropped the cub and turned to the elk. As if sensing the escalated threat, the buck struggled to stand, but its hind leg was ruined. The bull approached, the darkness falling fast. It leaned in toward the elk, raised its right arm. The elk screamed. The bull shrieked something, and the three young Abbeys leapt out into the circle and piled onto the elk, eating its guts which lay spilled and steaming in the grass. As the circle of Abbeys closed in to watch their young ones feed, Tobias lowered the rifle. There was enough noise and commotion that he reached for the pack and forced his hand inside, kept reaching and reaching until his fingers finally touched the bottle. He pulled it out, unscrewed the lid, poured the water down his throat. He slept shivering and dreaming of all that he had seen. The ruins of Seattle, a dense Pacific rainforest interspersed with toppled skyscrapers. The lower 100 feet of the Space Needle still standing, enwrapped in a riot of vines and undergrowth. Nothing remotely recognizable save Mount Rainier. From 60 miles away and after 2,000 years, it stood seemingly unchanged. He'd sat in a tree at the top of what had once been Queen Anne Hill, and wept at the sight of that mountain while the rainforest hummed with the chattering of animals that had never seen or smelled a human being. He dreamed of standing on a beach in Oregon, rock formations looming out of the mist like phantom ships. He'd taken a stick and scrawled, "Oregon, United States of America," in the sand, sat watching the sun go into the sea as the tide came in and smoothed the words out of existence. He dreamed of walking with no end in sight, of sleeping in trees and crossing rivers, dreamed of dreaming about his home in Wayward Pines, as many blankets as he wanted, a belly full of warm food, a door that locked, safety behind the fence, sleep without fear, and his woman. "When you come back, and you will come back, I'm gonna fuck you, soldier, like you just came home from war." She'd scribbled those words on the first page of his journal the night before he left. She didn't know where he was going, of course, only that he probably wouldn't make it back. He felt so tender toward her, and more so now than ever. If she only knew the number of cold and rainy nights when he'd read her last words and felt the glow of comfort. He dreamed of dying, of returning. And last, he dreamed of the most terrifying thing he'd seen in a long chain of terrifying things. He'd heard it and smelled it from 10 miles away, the noise coming from an old-growth redwood forest of 400-foot trees somewhere along the border of what had once been California and Oregon. As he approached, the noise became tremendous, like hundreds of thousands of sustained screeches. It was the biggest risk he'd taken in his 4 years beyond the fence, but his curiosity wouldn't let him turn back. Even days after, his hearing wasn't right. The volume 10 times louder than the loudest rock concert, like 1,000 jets taking off in unison. He crawled toward it, covered in makeshift forest floor camo. At 1/2 mile away, fear overrode his curiosity, and he couldn't bring himself to move another foot closer. He caught glimpses of it through the giant trees, the size of 10 football stadiums, the highest spires rising several 100 feet above the canopies of the redwoods. He stared through the scope of his rifle and tried to process what he saw, a structure made of millions of tons of dirt and logs and rock, all cemented together with some sort of resin. From where he'd lain, it had resembled a giant piece of black honeycomb, tens of thousands of individual cells teeming with aberrations and their stores of putrefying kills. The smell was eye-watering. The noise like 100,000 people being simultaneously skinned alive. It looked utterly alien, and as he crawled away from it, the realization hit him right between the eyes. That monstrosity was a city. The Abbeys were building a civilization. The planet was theirs. He woke. There was light again, a soft, tentative blue loitering in the clearing.
everything glazed with frost, and his pant legs had frozen stiff below the knee. The Abbeys were gone. He was shivering uncontrollably.